Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The XX Gab Fest is brought to you by MeUndies. MeUndies makes the world's most comfortable underwear in a variety of styles and patterns. Head to MeUndies.com/XX to get free shipping and 20% off your first order. And by Boll & Branch, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Get the nicest sheets you've ever owned for about half the price of what stores are charging. Order right now and they'll give you 20% off your order, plus free shipping. Go to bollandbranch.com, that's bollandbranch.com, and use the promo code XX. And by HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy and convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes complete with step-by-step instructions that are designed to take around 30 minutes to prepare. For $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter XX when you subscribe.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, January 28th, the Power Pony edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi. Oh, I forgot to say hi. I
was just like, hi.
Hello.
And that other girl. Hi. We got a lot of email this time. A lot of it with suggestions for leisure. Do you say leisure or do you just say leisure at this
point? I say leisure because I'm an American, just like I say buttock.
I say leisure because it's funnier.
We got a lot of leisure suggestions. Some of them were kind of X-rated, surprisingly.
That's
leisure,
right?
Suggestions. You know, soft X.
I say soft X, yeah.
Soft X,
we
yeah.
We were shamed. Masturbation, one reader told us, is the most... how did she put it? It was basically like... purposeless pleasure seeking activity of all. How could you have left it off? And it's true. How could we have left it off?
That's true. That's a good point. Although for many people it might be stressful. What do I know?
I just think leisure. I think of myself taking my leisure in my living room and like the people on the other side of the street can see right into my window. I'm like, yeah, that would not be relaxing.
There's a solution for that in
really?
America. It's called curtains.
Yeah, I live in New York City.
And we also got a lot of grief for condescending to women and youths because everyone was like, they have real reasons to support Bernie and not Hillary. We don't have to automatically support Hillary just because she's a woman. Now, I don't believe that in my heart, and I didn't feel that I was saying that. Nonetheless, that's what conveyed. So, I don't know. You guys don't feel that, right? It's not just because she's a woman.
I did see Susan Sarandon saying she doesn't vote with her vagina, and I thought, oh gosh, have I been doing it wrong all these years?
Do you hold the pen or do you use
in New York where you have this giant lever, until recently at least, that you have to pull, like, that would be really hard. That'd be some major Kegels.
I wonder if anyone would do that and, like, Instagram that. Like, just as a trick to learn.
Performance art.
Yeah. Okay. So we need maybe like a disclaimer for that whole section right there. You can't skip over it because it already happened. So our three topics today. First is the power pose. Amy Cuddy's idea. It's everywhere. Does it really make you more powery, powerish, power-like? We will discuss. Second, procrastination. Apparently now we're supposed to embrace it. We'll talk about it and also maybe our favorite ways of procrastinating. And finally, we're going to talk about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, a sort of new show on the CW, which we are very interested in. What do we make of this super bananas woman show on TV? What does it mean about this moment? I can't ever get this right. It's just such a crazy show, but we'll get there. It's so crazy. We'll get there. But let's start with the power pose. Amy Cuddy, who is a Harvard business professor, whose TED Talk is what? The second most watched TED Talk? I think that's right. That's what the news says.
What's the most watch? No. Do we know?
I can't believe I didn't look that up. When someone says second most, you're like, well, what's the first most?
The third most.
Yeah. It's about Wonder Woman pose is how some people call it. But that makes it seem like it's only for women, which it is not. But certain poses that you can do in order to make yourself feel more powerful. She has a new book called Presence, Bringing Your Boldest Self to Your Biggest Challenges. It's a self-help book with some science thrown in, and we are going to talk about it. First, I want to ask you, I definitely have friends who do power pose before interviews and before parties. I found this out as I was researching this. Have you guys ever done it or know anybody who does?
No.
No.
I mean, how did you get that admission out of your friends?
Oh, so you're already, okay, we already know your position. This is like embarrassing nonsense.
No, actually, that's not true. I believe strongly in a mind-body connection, but I find the idea of like going in a corner and doing Wonder Woman for 45 seconds before entering a party, like just a bridge too far for me personally. And if I did it, I wouldn't tell people about it.
But why? Because you're too cool for Wonder Woman? Why?
Yeah. That's it.
Have you seen her? Come on, of course she's too cool for Wonder Woman.
No, but I was like charmed by we will talk about the social science. There's been a lot of kind of pissing on the social science. It's not real. It's not deep. I mean, it's not that I didn't take it seriously. I understand that she is a business professor. There weren't that many people in her study. Someone did a much larger sample in which they could not replicate the findings. So that's significant. But I don't think it's that relevant whether the social science is excellent and perfect or not.
I don't know. That seems a bit much. I mean, I think from what Noreen just said that I agree with her point of view that... So Amy Cuddy, in her original study, which she did with two other people, found not only that if you do these poses, you feel more powerful, but her study suggested that your levels of testosterone go up and your levels of cortisone go down. So testosterone's associated with power, cortisol's associated with stress. So, this was, you know, pretty specific scientific feeling. And then there was also a finding about risk-taking behavior going up as well. And all the studies that have tried to replicate it have not been able to replicate the sort of statistical significance of the studies, but they have mostly found that there was a feeling of powerfulness that did increase, or people reported that. So,
like a vague feeling of powerfulness, but not measurable in your chemical hormones.
But exactly. Why does it need to be measurable in your chemical hormones?
Well, exactly.
It needs to be measurable if you're going to say in front of 48 million people on TED that this is real.
Right.
You know, like if you say that it does this thing, it has to do that thing. So because she's definitely using the scientific element, like, hey, no, there's science behind this. And you've seen that in various, you know, media places, people said, no, there's science behind this. There's really not. However, I can fully believe that if you just the mindfulness of it, if you say, I'm going to be powerful, I'm going to be confident, I'm going to, you know, you essentially you do like your Stuart Small bit. Mm-hmm. I believe that would have an effect. Sure. But that doesn't mean that the study really holds up.
Yeah. Well, who cares about the honestly, that's just because the culture requires put a veneer of chemistry. Or if she said we did an MRI and this region of the brain lit up, people would be really into that too. But yeah. It seems to me clearly a psychological phenomenon, like it's a kind of feedback loop. So if you believe in the power pose, then the power pose will help you. It's a cycle. It will make you feel more powerful because you've bought into the power pose. So when you read these testimonies, her book is extremely charming, although I want to talk more about the ways in which it's charming and why it's so hugely popular. But the book is pretty charming, and all these testimonies from people are fairly charming. And I think it's just like this very simple, accessible thing that it's easy. It's not like
effortless.
It's that hard.
No.
It's completely effortless. It's essentially like a tiny moment of meditation in your day. So if you have a habit of walking into a party in a certain way, or if you have a habit of, you know, stumbling your way through interviews or something, this is a moment when you can kind of take stock and tune into some other part of yourself, and you believe in this thing because she's like a nice woman and she says Harvard and testosterone and whatever. Right. And then you're set, and that's it. It's so easy.
I guess what I find ridiculous is the like bite-sized moment of it, to just sit in a corner and put your hands on your hips and like throw back your shoulders for 30 seconds or whatever. I totally buy that if you sit in a certain way in meetings, you are, you know, if you're hunched over, if your arms are crossed, you're projecting something both outwards and inwards. But to me, it's like the difference between like changing the way you eat and going on a crash diet or something.
This is crash diet.
It's like, I don't know, sitting like,
it's not even crash diet. It's like taking a pill to help you lose weight. Like, it's mostly in your head.
But you know, I'm power posing right now because I'm going to aggro you guys.
Why? No. I think we're actually all agreeing. We're just thinking.
No, I totally disagree. I don't think that it's a crash diet. I think it's something you can do every single time. You can do it every day. You can do it every morning before you go to work or before you go into a meeting. It's actually habit. Like, why? It's not a single, it's not that hard. Crash diet is when they're like, just drink shakes or do something crazy and radical. This is small.
I don't know.
Well, that's what I said. I said it's taking a pill. It's taking a pill. It's nonsense that is mostly bullshit, but that puts you in a certain frame of mind. And I mean, it's 99% bullshit.
Yeah.
But the 1% is like, good. That's 1% thing that you did. It's something that you did. It's good to do things. But it's mostly bullshit.
Why? Maybe we disagree over what bullshit means. To me, it's kind of profound in its simplicity. It's like this little thing that everyone can buy in and believe in that you can do every single day. It doesn't seem any more bullshit than meditation to me. I mean, meditation is a whole other science and there's lots of MRIs, etc. And you do it in a more deep, profound way and it has a trajectory. So, you know, you can do it for longer amounts of time and gain mastery of it, etc. This is just like one little thing you can repeat all day.
Yeah, it seems like a poor person's yoga or something to me, but I guess it's all along a continuum. Does your friend think it's helped her at parties? Like, she believes that.
And Hannah, are you your friend?
No, it's not just one friend. I actually talked to a lot of people. I sort of sent out an email to some friends, and a surprising number of people were like, "Yeah, I've tried it. I've tried it before this or that."
Were any of them men?
Well, okay, so can we talk about the gender angle? So this is the thing that's interesting to me, and we will echo some of this when we talk about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Amy Cuddy's own story is that she had a traumatic brain injury, and I mean, she was in a car accident, and she really thought that she was doomed. Like, she was never going to be smart again.
She was told that, by
yeah, like, she was
doctors.
Told that. Yeah. Like, your brain's not going to work. It's like the imposter syndrome, but with medical confirmation, you know? Like, it's not merely that you think you're never going to succeed. The doctor is echoing that back to you.
Yeah.
And so there's this moment of extreme vulnerability and then attached to this kind of reclaiming of power. That, in 2015, does feel to me like a woman's story. Even though if you read her TED Talk, she actually takes great pains. She says at the end, you know, you won't be surprised that the people who hunch over at meetings, they're more likely to be women. But for the most part, like, the images she projects are as often of dominant females and beta males. That's maybe an insulting term. I don't know what what's the non-dominant? Non-dominant, like,
submissive.
You know, submissive, maybe. Yes, thank you. But I didn't want to get like that. You know, I'm just trying to be like business meeting language, not your dirty mind kind of language. But
I was just simply saying what the other kind of animal was. But if you want to impute that mid-level dirtiness, by all means.
Mid-level employees.
She does seem to not want for this to be received as entirely another bit of advice for women to make it in the workplace. She doesn't want to be like lean in light. She doesn't seem to want that.
Well, I think people would find it less useful if it were just aimed at women. There's something about it that's like meant to make you not think about your gender, just make you think about yourself as a person in this room who's an actor in the world, who's taking up space in the world, which I think is good. And and if women happen to be looking for this advice more than men, fine. But like, I think that is part of the appeal of it.
And there's something, too, I think, with the way that she looks. I mean, there shouldn't be. This shouldn't be relevant. But she is a very petite, very blonde. And you see the pictures from her childhood, a natural blonde. And there's something about the way that she looks that I think is, like, in a way, is the ideal that is fed to a certain, like, this is what a sort of, I guess, middle-aged white woman, like, this is your goal. And she does happen to look like that. And I think if you see her in a video or, you know, a picture associated with, you know, a piece of media about the power pose, that kind of makes a difference, too, to some people, I think, because, hey, she's doing something. She's obviously doing a lot of working out and eating right. But, you know, hey, it's also helping with that, too.
Wait, are you saying that the idea sells because she's pretty? Is that what that whole...
Not so much about her appearance, but more just her size, her affect. Like, she's skinny and petite and blonde, and she's a certain, like...
Well, she looks like she might be fragile, and yet she's not.
I think
it's also the Ruth Bader Ginsburg appeal, where it's like, oh, you're underestimating me because I'm this delicate-looking woman, and yet, like, my strength is this huge thing about me, this important thing about me.
Yeah, and she is bird-like. Like, she has a bird-like way about her. I have to say, I love the word presence. I think that's a good goal. Presence is a good goal, because if you think of it as just the Wonder Woman pose, then it's like man-spreading or something. Like, we just all want to take up space and be really big and alpha. Right. But having presence seems to me a nice and neutral, positive term.
Yeah. I mean, don't be a shrinking violet. Like, that's a really, you know, if you've got something to say, say it. There's hardly anything negative about presence.
Yeah.
And presence is gender neutral. When I think presence, I don't think advice for women. I think there are men who could be more present in the room. Presence has like a meditative aspect, but it also has a like success, take up air in the room, you know, express yourself. It's a very nice word to have co-opted on her part.
Mm-hmm. Can I just tell you guys my Amy Cuddy story?
Please.
I
was reporting a story on the editor-in-chief of Cosmo a year ago, and I went to the Cosmo Fun Fearless Life conference in New York City, where Amy Cuddy was a star speaker, and her speech was totally great. I was like along for the ride. But the funniest part of it to me that I just can't quite get over is that she concluded the presentation, I believe, by showing a video that someone had sent in of their depressed Icelandic pony. And this pony owner had decided that the way to get this pony over its depression was to teach it to power pose like a stallion. So there are all these these clips of the pony posing like a stallion, and then it ends up with this like galloping pony who's totally thrown off its depression by like just pretending to be a stallion.
Wow.
And I just found that too absurd for words, but the rest of her presentation was very convincing.
That's awesome. Go from My Little Pony to My Present Pony in three easy tricks. That's awesome. All right. Well, listeners, if you are a power poser, please let us know. Let us know if it's ever helpful to you and what you think of power posing. Go onto our Facebook page or email us and tell us your power pose stories. Men and women, please. Let's move on to our next topic, which is procrastination. But before we do that, let's hear from our first sponsor.
Thanks, Hannah. This week, the XX GabFest is sponsored by MeUndies, and they are encouraging you not to be predictable and show up at your Valentine's Day dinner with some last-minute box of chocolates. Show your special someone just how much you care with MeUndies, the world's most comfortable underwear. MeUndies are made of micro-modal fabric, meaning they're twice as soft as cotton. And they don't just feel great, they look great too. MeUndies come in tons of cool prints and styles, and new designs come out every month. Don't miss February's limited edition design from the legendary artist Keith Haring. This retro design is inspired by love, making it the perfect Valentine's Day gift. And MeUndies has a keep-it-for-free guarantee. If you don't fall in love with your first pair, keep them and you'll get your money back, no questions asked. Order before February 4th in the US to make sure your pair arrives in time for Valentine's Day. That's MeUndies.com/XX for free shipping and 20% off your first order of the world's most comfortable underwear. Back to you, Hannah.
Thanks. All right, let's move on to our second topic, procrastination. We have for a long time been encouraged to be peaceful engines of constant production. And now there's some research that shows that procrastination is good for you. It makes you more creative. It allows your best ideas to surface and puts you in league with Steve Jobs, Aaron Sorkin, Bill Clinton, and many other classic and great procrastinators. Would either of you describe yourselves as a procrastinator?
Yeah.
I'm a recovering procrastinator.
Oh, tell us more.
Well, I used to be a terrible, terrible procrastinator because I was a terrible slacker. And now, like, I just have too much to do. And I just, like, I don't feel like I ever get to do any decent procrastinating anymore. I'm just too bloody busy.
I have, like, a very complicated system of procrastination. Basically, anything I get done in my life is because of procrastination, though. Like, it's like I only clean my house when I have a work deadline. And I like go to the gym when I'm avoiding work. And I like, you know, I organize my sock drawer when I'm avoiding work. Like, it's basically like all the things that I want to do, I get done because there's another thing that I just can't bring myself to do yet. So it's like,
but what about at the office? You can't do any of those things at the office.
At the office, we have this thing called the internet. And I always tell myself that I'm, quote, looking for story ideas, which is sort of true. I'm not a horrible procrastinator. Like, I don't usually blow deadlines. And I do think that there is something to this theory that, like, okay, as long as you're sort of thinking about the thing that is due, if you're doing creative work, like, it actually probably does benefit you to have it in the back of your mind and then to, like, force you to sit down and write it at some point. But you've already done a lot of the hard work of thinking.
I think those are different forms of procrastination. Hmm. So there was an op-ed by Adam Grant, who writes a lot with he's the one who writes with Sheryl Sandberg.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So he was writing about procrastination, and he said that he's a precrastinator. He was very Tracy Flick in how he described himself.
Right. He sounded like an alien to me.
Yeah. I don't really know that many people who are like that. Like, he just gets everything done right away. And so there's no creative. He just wants to get it done. And, you know, he anticipates the deadlines and gets things done early. I mean, so I think he's probably at the other end of an extreme. But one of his students, apparently, who's now a professor, Jihei Shin, I'm not sure how exactly about the first name's pronunciation. She did a study. She's now at the University of Wisconsin, where she asked people to come up with a new business idea. Some were allowed to play Minesweeper or Solitaire, and others were not. And then just to see what was the effect. Like, were their ideas better? Were they more fruitful? And it turned out that the people who were distracted at first actually did come up with better and more novel ideas. But I think that's because Minesweeper is kind of, it's not meditative exactly, but it's different from the work you're about to do. Mm-hmm. Just like folding socks and taking a walk and stuff is kind of gives your mind a break. Whereas reading news on the internet, to me, those two kinds of procrastination do not work the same way. So because most of us are at the office a lot, the kind of procrastination we do at the office is not that productive and conducive to creativity. Whereas when I'm at home, because I do write at home, then I just, like, do the dishes or do something which is different. And that's fabulous. Like, that often that, or take shower, like, that really leads to, you know, breakthroughs and stuff like that. But not like random Googling. That actually sucks to me.
Oh, totally.
I
think taking a walk is the world's best procrastination.
Yeah. It seems like taking a shower, taking a walk, these are things where the other things that you can do are limited. I mean, you see those weird people who walk down the street reading a book or, you know, doing honestly dangerous things. But for the most part, if you're a normal person, you can't. Like, there's just not a million other things that you can take. So you're just in your head in the best way possible. Mm-hmm. Although, can we just say, like, having sort of said that it's okay to have a bullshit study in the first segment, that study was clearly bullshit. I mean, come on. And people said, yeah, their ideas were more creative. It's like a lot of the, we keep citing studies, and these studies just seem such nonsense.
Well, the thing that I wondered about that is that, are the people who are drawn to procrastination just sort of like a little bit more creative? Not that organized people can't be creative, but it just was unclear which way the causation was running in that particular study.
I'm very curious. The Adam Grant piece about procrastinator, I know that a friend of mine who also writes a column for The Guardian about psychology called, I believe, This Column Will Change Your Life, Oliver Berkman.
That's awesome.
He did a piece about procrastination a couple of years ago. And one thing that he said was, if he also had a tendency to just get things done and he would beat deadlines like Adam Grant talked about. But when he tried not to, he realized that when you get something done, you just take care of a task, you kind of tick it off. You stop thinking about it. Your mind doesn't work on it anymore. Whereas when you just kind of put it off and you know, maybe intentionally, mindfully postpone, it's still open in your head and you're still kind of filing things away and your data is flowing through and just thinking of potential things that you could do with it. So that makes sense just on a, without doing any studies, but just on a, yeah, I can believe that kind of way.
Yeah, that was so interesting to me. And one of the pieces we read, there was the factoid that tasks you have completed in your life, you can't remember as well as the like open questions. Right. And I was thinking about it just like in my own writing, and I can remember vividly every story that, you know, was either killed or I never filed, and stories I've written and published. I have like, I'm amazed that it came out of my brain when I see it again. I'm like, really? I really? And that's just such a weird trick of the human brain.
Yeah, I was clearing some, like a pile of books yesterday that they were from the side of my bed. So I'd actually either intended to read them or I started reading them and abandoned them. And the ones that I'd gotten a little way through, I was like, oh, shall I keep reading this? Even if it was like 2 years ago. And the ones that I'd never started, some of them are like, I don't remember ever bringing this book into the house. But I suppose that's slightly different.
Yeah.
Related.
Well, here's my question. Okay. So, Hannah, you sometimes do the dishes when you procrastinate. I frequently, it's the only thing that can motivate me to like clean or go to the post office or whatever. Do you think that this relates back to our discussion last week of women and leisure? Do you think that there is something where we can't just let ourselves completely like do something non-productive when we're procrastinating? And is that gendered? I'm thinking about there's this author, Jenny Offel, who wrote a book that I haven't actually read. But
Department of Speculation.
Department of Speculation, which
that's
really
a fabulous book. Yeah.
I really want to read. But there's this passage that sort of like became a thing on the internet about how she was going to become an art monster. And she was just going to like abandon all other things in her life and, you know, not do the dishes, not lick the stamps. And she was just going to like devote herself to art. And that's a little different because it's like, you know, devoting yourself to the thing itself. But there was a clear gender implication in what she was saying, that, you know, women are not able to let these other tasks go. And I wonder if there's something you guys think that's going on with procrastination where we feel like we have to do productive procrastination.
That's, I think that is different because I am currently reading the novel by Siri Hufstedt called The Blazing World, which is about the same thing. A woman who actually conducts this experiment where she has her art. She puts her art out in the world through three men. She convinces three men to put her art out in the world, and they become these, like, you know, they become famous. And the whole novel is about women and art and permission to be big that way and why certain things. I think that's different. I just think that's a different set of issues than the issue of whether women just allow themselves to do nothing. I mean, I remember once being at Slate and it was the middle of the day and it was the World Cup. And all the dudes, my husband included, were sitting in the lunchroom or watching the World Cup for like hours in the middle of the workday. And I mean, that's an extreme example. But I think, like, is there a woman equivalent of that? Like, I just couldn't imagine giving myself permission in the middle of the workday to watch a couple of hours of soccer or whatever it is I like to watch. I don't know if that's the woman in me or like the immigrant in me. I don't know what it is in me that just found that scene. It has stuck with me for many years, and I just found it was so alien to me that you would allow yourself to do that. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's like, why do I do the dishes? I mean, I don't work at home anymore, so I can't do, I mean, I don't do like NPR random dishes in the sink. That would be truly weird, but. But I think there must be something to that. Somebody sent us a great study, which I posted on our Facebook page, about the difference between how men and women experience leisure, which is basically women don't experience leisure and men do. You know, that as women's lives have gotten squeezed over the last 30, 40 years, kids, work, whatever, they have squeezed out leisure time and not men.
I can't imagine watching a soccer game in the middle of the day. But the thing that I find truly amazing about that, and actually a little bit aspirational, is doing it openly.
But in that situation, Hannah's husband, David, was the boss,
right,
and he was doing it so people could follow his lead.
Right. And actually, maybe it was a way of getting in with the boss.
I'm not at all disdainful. I'm not a procrastinator, but I'm really not a procrastinator. I don't procrastinate or allow myself to. And I feel that that's a complete character failing. I do not admire it in myself. I think it's really weird. And I just think that something in my brain has like trained me. I just don't procrastinate that much. And I think it's lame. I genuinely think it's lame. This isn't like, I'm a team player and a self-starter. I'm too old for that now. I just right. think it's lame, like, to not be able to just, like, to take things so seriously. Like, why?
You know? I don't know. I think it's very helpful. As someone who does some work with you, it's very helpful. You always get things going.
What about this idea that if you are a procrastinator, other people have to pick up your slack, which, to quote Amy Cuddy, often it tends to be women who are picking up your slack. Maybe that's true. Maybe that isn't in your workplaces. But what do you guys think of that idea?
Yeah, that's sort of one of the most maddening things to see happening. And it isn't always men, but it sometimes is. And I've probably been guilty of this at work where I haven't done something and then someone else does it. But more often I've sort of felt like, okay, this thing isn't getting done. I'll just do it because it will drive me a little bit nuts to not have it get done. And actually, it's very motivating for me to see something not getting done in a weird way, to see someone else procrastinating. That, like, sort of lights a fire under me.
See, and for me, it's part of my, like, I used to be a horrific procrastinator. And I think at the time I was blind to the effect of it, because really I was putting other people out. Mm-hmm. I was causing delays, or I was just making people twiddle their thumbs waiting for me to finally get to do this thing which they had asked me to do by a certain date, and here I was crashing on it now. And now I think, I hadn't even really thought of this before, but now I think I might be making up for that in a weird psychic way, because now I do what you just described of, like, oh, I'm just going to take care of this and get it out of the way. And that does actually relieve me of something. Mm-hmm. Like, it kind of pre-relieves you of stress that you know you're going to have. But I also think maybe it is some big cosmic makeup.
Yeah, there's also an element of being in control in that situation. Yeah, like, yeah. I can't count on this other person to do it. I can always count on myself.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is a chaos control angle. Like, for some people, control puts their mind at ease, so they have to have everything checked off their list every day, and other people are comfortable with greater amounts of chaos. And like you said, Noreen, maybe those are just the naturally more creative people who are comfortable with chaos. Anyway, I want to just weigh in here on the family element of this, because I feel like this taps into my most visceral feminist rage, is it because David's away a lot. I mean, David's very fair and equal, but I mean, like, when we're without David, and I notice that it's me and my daughter, you know, making the dinner. And she's the oldest, so that counts too. But when the boys just, like, sit back when the dinner's done and go read their books or whatever, it makes me crazy. Like, I want to slam dishes on everyone's head. Crazy, you know? So that is like a thing that I try and enforce. Like, that dynamic of women are doing the work. Men are slacking, you know? Uh-huh. They don't feel like putting the dishes away or cleaning. It's the women do the work. I hate that. So I try to not let them get away with that.
Right on.
Okay, right on, sisters. listeners, if you don't have any power pose things to tell us how you procrastinate and whether you loathe your procrastination or whether you think it's a positive thing on our Facebook page, or email us. Okay, let's move on to our next topic, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. But before we do that, let's thank our next sponsor.
The XX Gabfest this week is also brought to you by Bowl and Branch. So I'm one of these people who makes a million New Year's resolutions, and one of them this year is to get really, really good sleep. It seems like, you know, every study you read, how can you improve your life? It's like, drink more water and get good sleep. I have lived too much of my life with cheap sheets that I bought for a low price on Amazon. And it turns out that, you know, having good quality sheets can improve your quality of sleep. And one company has set out to make this possible. It's Bowl and Branch. They've reinvented sheets and bedding with the sole purpose of making your nights more comfortable than ever. And the more comfortable your nights are, the longer you're able to sleep. So go online to Bowl, that's B-O-L-L, and branch.com, and they'll let you try them risk-free for 30 nights. So you can actually, if you don't like them, you can return them. And it gets even better. So you can go there, bowlandbranch.com, for 20% off your entire order. Sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, everything, plus free shipping. So in order to get that 20% discount, you want to use the promo code XX. That's D-O-U-B-L-E-X. All right, back to the show.
All right, let's move on to our third topic, which I'm so excited to discuss, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. It's a comedy television series. Is that a thing, June? Can you say it's a musical comedy TV series? Is that a genre?
Well, it's It and Glee, which is now no longer on the air. So I guess that's it right now. There aren't any other musical shows on at the moment. I think Flight of the Conchords was once a similar show, but they're unusual.
It premiered in October in the fall on the CW. It was created by Rachel Bloom and, help me out, it's Aline Broche McKenna.
That's
is that
right.
How you pronounce her name? Okay. Uh-huh. Okay, and Bloom is the lead. She plays a super batshit crazy, that's fair, right? Yeah. Super crazy single woman. I mean, explicitly, like, she is crazy. She's both clinically depressed and also just kind of socially crazy, but also extremely competent. And she moves to a town called West Covina, a real place in California, because a guy she went out with in summer camp named Josh, who dumped her after their summer fling, lives there, although she doesn't admit that that's why she moves there. So it revolves around her antics with the law firm that she goes to work at because she was a big-time lawyer in New York, and around Josh and around Josh's really good friend, Greg. So let's hear a little clip of the beginning. You just get a sense of her voice and what the show sounds like.
Good morning, sir. See the sparkle of the concrete ground. Hear the whoosh of the bustling town. What a feeling of love in my gut. I'm falling faster than the middle school's music program was cut.
People dine at Shea Appleby's. And the sky seems to smile at me. It's all new, but I have no fear.
Accidentes.
And also by coincidence, Josh just happens to be here. Seen a pretzel this big. It's my destiny, that much is clear.
Please welcome Destiny.
And also this guy Josh just happens to be here. Is he here? He's not here. To be clear, I didn't move here for Josh. I just needed a change, cause to move here for Josh, now that'd be strange. But don't get me wrong, if he asked for a date, I would totally be like, that sounds great. Did it sound cool when I said that sounds great? Okay, how about now? That sounds great. Yes, I heard of West Covina from Josh, but I didn't move here because of Josh. Do you get those things are different?
No hablo inglés.
Entiendes que son diferentes. Look, everyone, stop giving me the shakedown. I am not having a nervous.
All right. Amazing. That's like a demented, neurotic Disney princess. Exactly. That's what that song sounds like. Yeah. So, Noreen, you got drawn in, right? We made you watch it, but then you kind of got sucked into it. What was your visceral immediate response to the show? Like, you're hate watching?
No. Like, I'm just enjoyably watching. Like, if you had played me that clip, I would have been like, not for me. I am not a musical theater person. It's just not for me. But I think what I enjoy about the show is I think what she's skewering. I mean, first of all, it's just funny. Like, her observations are funny. But to me, the main thing she's skewering is this idea that everyone's kind of gotten in her crazy girl. And this woman just happens to be letting a lot of hers slip out to the outside, you know, whether it's because she sort of threw out her meds in the first episode or for whatever reason. But a lot of what she seems to be saying is like everyone has these sort of crazy thoughts, like maybe particularly around romance. And this girl is just totally letting her freak flag fly. And a lot of people have written about the show as being about mental illness because, you know, pretty explicitly she is someone who's depressed or has other things going on. But actually what struck me is she's not that much crazier than other people we see on TV. It's just the fact that it's written into her storyline. Like if you thought about Liz Lemon or Leslie Knope, like if you'd given them a pillbox, you could totally have made them the poster children for mental illness. It's just the idea that, you know, it's part of the storyline, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, it's explicit. And we should also note that when she was throwing out her pills, it's just that they weren't the right pills. She's not, it's not like testifying that, oh, you know, nobody should be medicated. It's not got a message like that. It's just like, you should be on the right medicine. It should make you feel good. It shouldn't bring you down. And there's
I thought she was throwing them out because, like, now I'm in West Covina and everything's going to be perfect because Josh is here and the sun is up and it's all great and I left my terrible job and it was just like a thing that people do.
No.
Like, I'm turning over a new leaf.
Well, no, she does seem like a totally different person in the New York part and the West Covina part, which sort of suggests, you know, like someone whose brain chemistry has changed.
No, there's definitely both of those things are true. Like, yes, she was on the wrong pills. She's still on pills. They're just the right pills. And West Covina is the right place for her. There was a song in this week's episode, which actually it wasn't a very good episode. It was kind of a bottle episode in a party buzz. But there was a really nice sort of interaction with Josh where you know, she does another reprise of the West Covina song, and they sing it together in this really nice duet. And you have the feeling that, yes, this is the right place for her. She wasn't happy in the big city. Manhattan exacerbated her feelings of isolation, of alienation, and in West Covina, she does feel more loved. She still hasn't really made a connection with people, and she's still not with Josh, but it is really good for her, and like, that was a good move, and that was something good that she did for herself. So it's not that, oh, throw away your pills, everyone. That's not the message, but it's like, hey, find the right pills.
They also set it up so that you're supposed to disbelieve that she didn't move there for Josh. That was a double negative. You're not supposed to trust her when she says, I didn't move here for Josh. But part of me thinks maybe the whole series is moving towards Josh is also such an unworthy object of affection. I mean, he's not, there's nothing wrong with Josh. He's just like a blank. Like, it's clear he's not nearly as interesting as she is. And
he's very sweet.
Yeah, he's a sweet
guy. He's very
sweet.
He's
just a slacker who rides his skateboard at 35 or whatever he is, 30.
Yeah, has no interesting thoughts. Like, his friends are much more interesting than he is.
Really?
And so, well, I don't know.
Greg
but maybe
is.
She. Greg but let is, me just say, me maybe not the, all the friends, but just Greg. The rest of them are just funny sidekicks. But maybe she did move there for the right reason. You know, maybe like eventually you're supposed to understand across the series that it was a good decision. Like, it was good for her to get out of New York and move to this more normal place.
Absolutely.
I don't know.
I think that's what I said, actually.
Oh, dang.
Do you guys find
I used more words, so
do you guys find the title offensive or funny?
No, I mean, if you had never seen the show, like, I remember, you know, when they announced all of the fall shows, because I believe it had originally been pitched to Showtime, where it would have been a half-hour show, and when it was picked up by the CW, it was going to be an hour-long show, and obviously with different standards between a premium channel where there's no, you know, no restrictions on what you can say or do, and, you know, a network show that's mostly intended to younger people. So they didn't have anything to show, really. And so when you just saw the title, there was a like, because there have been so many bad shows, you know, around women, and also just like good shows with bad titles. So it was like something that was freighted. But once you see the show, even for a minute, and see the tone of the show, you see that it is so knowing and so like also kind of accurate.
You know, I overlaid Amy Cuddy on this a little bit because I was watching Power Pose and listening to this. Just a little bit. Just the sense that, you know, one part of the show is always wrapping up with her hyper-competent lawyering. Mm-hmm. Like, she is, on the one hand, just really kind of floridly falling apart in every episode and making terrible decisions and doing ridiculous things. And also being an excellent lawyer and really solving people's problems. And that just felt something about that yin-yang felt very of the moment.
No, that's such a classic rom-com trope, right? Like, the heroine always has like a big job that she's really good at, and the one thing missing in her life is that she just can't get it together in her love life. You know, that I feel like that's all of them. To me, that feels like sort of down the middle for the rom-com genre.
I mean, it's still necessary, though, because, you know, she went to Yale and Harvard and she's super smart, and it makes it more okay that she's such a mess in other parts of her life. Even
you're
if
you're only
is
allowed to be a mess if you went to Harvard, guys. Did
exactly.
You not get the memo?
Exactly. No, I mean, but it that's exactly, you know, it would, if she was a community college dropout, if she was her neighbor, it would be much more problematic.
I love her neighbor. Her neighbor is this, like, very cool girl who's literally studying her for her abnormal psych class. And the neighbor gets her on Tinder and then, like, goes with her to the date and is, like, subject is prone to risky decisions, impulsive decisions. The neighbor is really funny. But I also, I mean, the show is very funny and skewering. And back to Harvard, one of the characters, Josh's like yoga doing coconut oil using girlfriend, who's, you know, meant to be sort of like the vapid green juice drinking person, goes, do all people who went to Harvard talk about it this much? And she's kind of like, yeah, which I appreciate it.
Uh-huh, they do. Can we talk about how this show is really like Inside Amy Schumer with a dramatic storyline? I mean, quite often when there are songs, they actually think the only other person who could say anything, certainly sing anything like this on television, would be Amy Schumer. Like, I'm thinking of the song that included Ass Blood from Anal Waxing, which, like, on the CW, guys, I mean, it's kind of amazing. And that was like an entirely Amy Schumer song.
It felt weirder than Amy Schumer, actually, to me in a good way. Like, it felt more original, maybe just because it's so unexpected within the show. And, like, Amy Schumer's whole shtick has become, like, feminist lessons dressed up in sketch comedy. Uh-huh. But this just felt weird.
Yeah, like sexy French depression is a little bit feminist. It's like the way we romanticize depressed women and the French people. But it was weirder. It didn't feel feminist, even though it kind of was feminist.
Yeah, it's not after school lesson. It's like the feminism is like the B plot or the C plot. It's not like what she's leading with, which I kind of appreciated. What do you guys think the songs represent? Like, are they her inner monologue? Are they like a Greek chorus? Are they sort of like, you know, moments where she just wants to step out and draw a lesson? Is she just like a musical theater geek who can't not have them in there? Like, do they mean something?
I think, like in most musicals, there are mental pauses. You know, there's a tension in that moment or something unexpressed in that moment. So you just put brackets on it and play a song. You put it in song, you know. So she's having a thought, like he's asked her on a date. She's deciding if she's going to say yes or, you know, there's something unexpressed. Like when Greg asks her on a date and he's recognizing that he's her second choice. That's subterranean, so you just surface it in song.
I'm gonna tell you what it's not. What the songs are not are, like I think they often were on Glee, like a chance to make money. Like they use original songs for some reason to really up the degree of difficulty, which on this show is amazingly high already. They committed to never doing the same genre twice. So they've got 38 songs for the 18 episodes of the first season, and they're all in different tones and different styles of music. It's kind of crazy. And
how do they do it? The songs are great. I mean, they have a high hit rate with those songs. They're really pretty good. Yeah. How do they do it?
I mean, it's literally two guys writing them, a choreographer, and it's just so hard because she is in almost every scene. So to get her to be just have rehearsed those songs, to have been involved in, you know, just the act of doing them, because when you add songs, it's just it takes so much time, extra, you know, just things that you have to do to get the episode ready. It's just insanely difficult. There's so much risk involved in the show. And I have to say, the ratings are not very good. If it was on any other network, and in any other season, I would say it would have been pulled because the ratings are terrible. But it's very, very popular with critics. And it also, you know, she won a Golden Globe. Rachel Bloom won a Golden Globe, which I love how we always think that the Golden Globes are ridiculous until someone we like wins. And then, oh, she won a Golden Globe. And so there is this feeling of underlying force of love for it, but it's not particularly popular.
Yeah. Well, also, who you're supposed to ally with. I mean, I love it. But people I've watched it with don't, because they find her so grating. You know, she's like Rachel on Glee. And so it's like every episode, you know, just plays with that balance. Like, are we going to just make her too annoying to stand, or are you going to love her? So I end up loving her, but I could see how you wouldn't.
I don't. I think she's so lovable.
I do too.
Okay. Well, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend on the CW. We encourage you all to watch it. Tell us if you like it, if you don't like it, just what your thoughts are about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Let's move on to our recommendations. But before we do that, let's thank our third sponsor.
All right. Double X is also brought to you this week by HelloFresh. So I'm someone who works late a lot, come home, I want to eat something healthy, and then I end up turning to delivery, which is never as healthy as you think it is. There's all kinds of salt in there. Who knows what oil they're cooking in? So instead, you can turn to HelloFresh, which is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. So each week, you get a new delicious recipe that has step-by-step instructions, so sort of no room for error. And it only takes around 30 minutes for everyone from novices to, you know, people who cook all the time. So that is faster than delivery in most places. HelloFresh also sources the freshest ingredients, which are measured to the exact quantities needed. So you don't do that thing where you go in your fridge and you're like, oh, shoot, the cauliflower went bad. I feel so guilty. So not only are you doing your part to combat food waste, but you're also getting food that's healthy. So HelloFresh employs a full-time registered dietitian who reviews each recipe to ensure it is nutritionally balanced. Man, I would love to have a full-time registered dietitian always telling me that my food is balanced or not. And every meal kit is delivered right to your door in a special insulated box for free. So like delivery, but healthy, and you feel a lot more virtuous. So if you want to try this out and you want to get $35 off your first week of deliveries, go to HelloFresh.com and enter XXDOUBLEX when you subscribe.
All right, recommendations. June, why don't you go first?
Well, since we've been talking about the CW, I watch lots of shows on the CW, but I am, you know, as I usually take pride in being a kind of early adopter for shows, there's one that I am really a junie come lately to. I'm just starting to watch it as it's, the show itself has just started its third season, and I'm back in season one just like catching up, but it's kind of amazing, and it is The 100. It's kind of a, it's, you know, it starts off, they're in space, you know, the Earth was blown up and radiated, and so they're off on an arc up in space, but then the arc is fading, so they send down 100 hot teenagers to Earth to see if they can make a go of it there. And that sounds such a terrible setup, but it's actually kind of amazing. So it's got elements of Hunger Games, it's got elements of, I don't know, every teen drama. But the teens, especially the teen girls, are really smart and really good at surviving and making good decisions. And there are really pretty complicated sort of issues in there. So The 100 on the CW. Get into it. Like me.
Sounds interesting. I have a new podcast that I love. It is called Pilot. It's done by Stephanie Fu, who's a reporter at This American Life. It's such a genius idea. So every episode is like a pilot episode for a new kind of podcast. And so she just is like, here's my idea. Here's the execution. Anybody wants it, take it from there. Wow. But she herself executes them so awesomely. And the second one is so interesting. It's hard to explain, but it's like a fake interviewer interviewing people about what is Christmas. It's basically like how an American interviewer would interview people about Diwali, in that kind of like combination, condescending, patronizing, and just like fake curious way. It's just so brilliantly done. Anyway, it's Pilot by Stephanie Fu. Okay, Noreen.
So I really hunkered down in the blizzard of 2016 in New York City. My phone told me that I only walked 0.19 miles on Saturday, which is really kind of a feat, if I will say so myself. But one of the things that I watched on Netflix while not walking was this movie about fitness. This movie is called Results, and it's by the filmmaker Andrew Bajalski, who's sort of like known for, I guess, mumblecore-ish things.
Normalcore.
It's not. I think mumblecore preceded normcore.
Yeah.
But I like his stuff, and this movie was like much more of a traditional rom-com. It's about two personal trainers in Austin, Texas, sort of trying to fix this unfixable client. And they have a history, and it becomes sort of a love triangle. And it's very charming. And I came across it. Wesley Morris, the critic for The New York Times, wrote this piece about things that had been overlooked, you know, movies that are really good that are never going to get nominated for Oscars. And this was one of the ones that he suggested checking out. And I fully second that. It's great.
Awesome.
Interesting.
Why are we laughing? All right. Well, thank you both. Thanks to our fabulous producer, Anne Hepperman. Thanks to the managing producer of Slate Podcasts, Steve Lichtai. To Andy Bowers, the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. To find out more about the show, go to our show page, slate.com/xx. Please comment, suggest, answer our questions on our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabfest, or email us at XXGabfest. Gabfest at slate.com. Subscribe on iTunes or anywhere else where you get podcasts so other people can find out about the show. For June and Noreen, I am Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Hey, this is Brian Koppelman. I host the Slate podcast, The Moment. Each week, I talk to somebody who has excelled in a creative field, movies, art, books. I'm talking about people like Salman Rushdie.
The war is against pleasure.
Amy Schumer.
I was already headlining and I still didn't feel like a comedian.
And I ask them how and why they do what they do. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts or at iTunes.com/The Moment.